بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. Dear brothers and sisters, سلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Annual gains minus مؤونة in brackets divided by 5, that is the amount one must pay خمس wise when the خمس date or year arrives. And inshallah, in this session, we're going to dissect the concept and notion of what the khums year is and what it entails. But before we start that subject matter, I just want to end off where we were, where we left in the last session. We were discussing the different forms of deductions from the annual gains, the different forms of ma'une, and I just want to end with these two different areas which many people ask, and I want to give the general principles in relation to these two areas. But you have to then apply them in your practical lives. You have to see how it's applied. I will give you the general principles, but when it comes to the application, maybe I may err. And then here in the application, everyone to their own, the duty bound. It's up to the duty bound, him or herself, to kind of get to the application, get to the actual particularity of that general principle. So the two domains are insurance and retirement policies. Slide 30, insurance policies. Here, the money the insurance person pays you after the accident or injury, that enters your annual gains due to the nature of the contract, i.e. it qualifies as an earning and it qualifies as a gain. Remember, earning was muktasabatun, the criterion for Ayatollah Khomeini, whereas gain in absolute terms was Ayatollah Sistani's criterion. The money that the insurance person gives you, it qualifies as an earning because the likes of Ayatollah Khomeini say that this is a contract made between you and another party, and the nature of this contract is such that it qualifies as an earning. You give them monthly segments, and then if something happens, then you will be insured. The nature of the contract, Ayatollah Khomeini says, makes it qualify as an earning. With Ayatollah Sistani, here the nature of the contract is seen in a similar light, but that which you're gaining doesn't have to necessarily qualify as an earning. If it does, then it qualifies as a gain a fortiori. But even if it doesn't, it still applies as a gain. It qualifies as a gain. And so, when the insurance person gives you something after the accident or the injury and so on and so forth, here, that money which you receive enters your annual gains. Look how important the definition of annual gains is. We trace everything back to annual gains because khums is levied on annual gains. Okay, and so when it enters your annual gains, the khums is levied upon it, and you have to pay the khums after a year. Whatever remains of that insurance money that you received, whatever remains at the end of the year, the khums year, then the khums has to be paid. Now, this is according to both Ayatollahs. Now, so the money that you give on a monthly basis to the insurance company, that would be seen as a ma'une because it's a livelihood expense. You want to protect yourself. You have that right in the medical field, in security-wise, and so on and so forth. And that much money you receive were something to happen to you, that enters your annual gains, and when it enters your annual gains, you can deduct the necessary livelihood expenses from them until you reach the khums date, and then whatever remains from your annual gains, the khums will be levied and you would have to pay it. But let's say now you pass away and the contract that you made provides something for your family members. Now, that which your family members receive after you pass away, that now won't qualify as an earning, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. He would see that as a form of beneficence, like a gift. And so, because after all, the family members, they didn't make any contract with anyone for it to qualify as an earning. And so no khums will be levied upon that money which is received by the family members. They don't have to pay the khums on that. Why? Because if you remember, with Ayatollah Khamenei, khums is not levied on gifts. But according to Ayatollah Sistani, the gift too enters your annual gains. And so anything that remains after a year, let's say the gift is money, whatever remains after a year, the khums would be levied upon that money. Remember, money is, you spend money. Sometimes a gift may be the television. Using it means there's no khums levied on it. Just simply using it because you need it and you use it. But with cash, it's like rice. It's like oil because it becomes depleted. So when you spend your cash, this is a gift you receive, the family members of the deceased, they receive it from the insurance company, for example. And whatever they receive, it's a gift. Now that gift is like the non-durable, the soft goods. You spend it, but whatever remains of the cash gift, whatever remains, then at the end of the year, the khums date, the khums has to be paid on it. That is Ayatollah Sistani's ruling. But with Ayatollah Khamenei, the receiving of the insurance money by the family members, since it doesn't qualify as an earning, it won't be an annual gain and the khums will not be levied on it. Okay. And then the second issue is the retirement policies. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, the same reason or the same reasoning used for insurers and the insured, you know, that the nature of the contract made applies here too. And with this scheme, it entails a form of contract and therefore it qualifies as an earning. With Ayatollah Sistani, the same applies and the same qualifies a fortiori. If it's an earning, it's going to be a gain. Any earning is a gain. Not every gain is an earning. And so in both cases, after one reaches one's khums year, the amount left from the retirement, for example, monthly, what they've received on a monthly basis after they've retired, whatever they receive here, whatever's left, you have the year to spend it. Whatever's left at the end of the year, the khums will have to be paid. Okay, so that was just to complete just that section from last week. Okay, now let's go to slide 31. Now we have a diagram here, and on this diagram, the horizontal arrow, the white line, is depicting the time scale. And below the month of March, we have two stars, and that is your khums date, for example. Let's say it's March the 13th. So when March the 13th happens, when it comes rather, you have to pay your khums, annual gains minus ma'una divided by 5. And then you start the year anew. You have a salary, you have a monthly salary. They are your annual gains. And at the same time, you're paying for your livelihood expenses. It's not as if you calculate the ma'una right at the end. You've already calculated the ma'una. The ma'una is being spent and is being deducted from your annual expenses day after day, okay? And then until the next March the 13th, then you see how much of your annual gains are left, and then the khums will be have, has to be calculated and paid. Now, a few questions here now. We have to open up. What determines your Khums year? That's the first question. Is it something that you can do optionally or not? Why is a year used rather than a month or a week? And most important of all, what happens exactly when your Khums year or date arrives? What is happening? This is a crucial matter. That what exactly is happening and the consequences of this, what is happening, is something which we have to then open up, inshallah, in the last or the next session, inshallah. And also, how is it happening? Okay, so at the bottom, these are the questions that we're going to answer, inshallah, in this session. So at the bottom, you see that very important pivotal equation that we've gone through almost in every week for the past two months. Annual gains minus ma'one divided by 5. Okay. What determines your Khums year? Slide 32. Is the Khums year determination something which is under your authority? That's the first thing we want to appreciate and acknowledge. Secondly, can it be altered? That which we've established over the last few weeks is that the Khums is levied upon annual gains. The Khums can only be levied on that which qualifies as your annual gain. And that was Malun, Mamlukatun, Muktasabatun, according to Ayatollah Khomeini, or Malun, Mamlukatun, Fa'idatun, according to Ayatollah Sistani. And so that which remains of the annual gains after the necessary deductions, minus ma'one, there the khums will be levied upon whatever remains of the annual gains. And khums means a fifth, so it's divided by 5, and there that is the amount that has to be paid. Hence, the time one's first annual gain is actualized, that is your khums year. So it's not something you can just choose nilly-willy to start off with. Your khums year is when your first annual gain is actualized. That is the general ruling. And that's the general criterion. Now, it may be a general principle, and the religious authorities may understand it in different ways. But that's the general criterion, that one's first annual gain, whenever that is, that is your khums date. Now, with this general principle, it applies differently to different people, depending on the nature of their work or income or what they've received. So, for example, for people who receive monthly wages, Ayatollah Khomeini says that one's first annual gain is actualized. When is it? He says it's the time when one has the has potential access to one's wages. So one is receiving monthly wages. That is, for example, they're a computer engineer. Every month they receive, you know, a certain salary. When one has the potential access to one's wages, for example, they have access either at hand, they give the money in an envelope, or they send the money, transfer it to their bank account, and they have access to the bank account. Whenever that happens, for these people, people who get monthly wages, that is the khums date. That is your khums date. And that's usually 1 month after you starting work. That's when they give the money at hand, in your hand, or they transfer it to the bank. When that happens, that date, that is your khums year. That is your khums date. Look, it wasn't your choice. Okay, it was something which was based on you gaining. And for you, who are having a salary on a monthly basis, after 1 month, when they give you the money, either in hand or the bank, you have access, that would be your first date. That would be your khums date. Okay. Whereas with Ayatollah Sistani, he says the criterion, he applies it in this way, that it's the start of one's actually working. So that would be day one at work. So there's a difference here. The general criterion is the same, but the application of it, the two religious authorities have differed in its application. 90% of the differences between the maraji, between the religious authorities, are not differences in the general principles. They are differences in the application of the general principles. And that's something which is very important to bear in mind. Otherwise, with the general principles, here they hardly differ. It's when they apply them in the particularities, they differ there. And that's okay, that's only natural for that to happen. So, with Ayatollah Sistani then, when you start your first job, that first day at work, that is your khums date. Okay, let's go to another category of people. Those whose jobs are trade related. Okay, like a confectionery's, a clothes shop and other things. Here, Ayatollah Khamenei, again, he says, the potential access of profit of work, i.e. when the profit that you, in a clothes shop, for example, the profit that you have access to, either in your hand or they with a credit card, for example, they send it to your bank account. Here, that access that you have, when it starts, that first profit, that is your khums date. And that, let's say if you open a clothes shop, what happens usually is maybe on day one, maybe on day two, people will come and purchase a piece of clothing. So it starts usually maybe on day one. Or if it's a confectionery shop, they come and start buying things from day one. So that usually happens at day one at work. But one may be unlucky and may have no customers after opening the shop, may have no customers for the first 5 days. And on the sixth day, they have one. That sixth day would be the khums state of that individual. With Ayatollah Sistani, however, it's like with the salary jobs. Day one of working is one's khums state, when you start working. Now, maybe there may be one or two days there are no customers and you don't work. That's okay. But when you start the working, that would be your khums state. So it's the same here in this second genre of jobs. The two religious authorities with a different wording, but in practical terms, it's the same. And with the third group in the agricultural domain, here, for those who await harvest of X, whatever X is, or the growth of whatever fruits and so on and so forth, all the religious authorities, including these two, say it's your home state is the time of produce, the actual time of the harvest happening. When the harvest is actualizing, that is your khums date. So you see that with these three kinds of jobs, we have different khums dates. Now remember, with Ayatollah Sistani, however, annual gains includes birthday presents. So the first annual gain for followers of people like the majority who say annual gains or belongings that are your own and that are that qualify as a gain, here, well, birthday presents apply too. If you go to slide 33, here, for many in the West, the concept of birthdays and birthday presents is probably the first time one gains something. So one's the actualization of one's first annual gain for followers of Ayatollah Sistani would be at one's birthday. Whereas with Ayatollah Khamenei, that's not the case because they're not khums leviable. Gifts, birthday presents are not khums leviable. And these birthday presents, though, they usually don't remain after a year because they spend it. However, it does determine your khums date because it actualizes as you gaining something. And so your birthday would most probably be your khums date if you follow Ayatollah Sistani. Even though when a year passes, you've spent it all, because birthday presents, you know, like £10, £20, something like that. Now, otherwise, if it's a durable birthday present, just playing with it or using it, it has no harms. Now, this scenario of the birthday will continue, even though you're going to spend it after the first day on receiving your birthday present. In practical terms, there's no harms on it, but the harms date is set. But this scenario will continue until you find a job. Let me, you know, repeat. This only pertains to followers of Ayatollah Sistani, because now when you find, because with Ayatollah Khomeini there's no humps on gifts. But when you find a job now, the job predominates over the birthday year, and this is usually accepted by religious authorities with this criterion, because of the small and temporary nature of the gift. So, first of all, the gift never usually doesn't remain until the next year, if it's cash. And even if it does, very small amounts of it remain, and therefore the khums is very minute. And thirdly, when you now start a job and receive monthly salaries, for example, now you're receiving much more annual gains. And then this kind of predominates and takes over. And so your home state is more in connection with, especially those at a young age, is more in connection with your job once you start the job. Before that, okay, it's your birthday date, but once the job comes, that will kind of overrule. Okay, on the same slide, the question now of why 1 year? Why do we calculate it, or why is it necessary to pay it after 1 year? The reason for 1 year is because of those traditions that stated al-khumsu ba'd al-ma'una, that the khums is after one's ma'una, which means, in paraphrase, the payment of the khums is due after one deducts the ma'una. That's the hadith. You pay the khums after the ma'une has been deducted. But the problem is that the ma'une is used in the absolute sense. Well, it's not a problem. It's just a technical point that the jurists pay attention to when analyzing the ahadith. So here, the ma'une is used in the absolute sense. When it's used in the absolute sense, what we mean is that we don't have a definition of ma'une according to the Sharia. And when we don't have a definition of the ma'una according to the Sharia, it means that the Sharia hasn't determined a specific time frame for the ma'una. When this happens, the jurist then goes to the common layperson, urf, laity, in Arabic, urf, very important term. Because the Sharia hasn't given a definition, we go to the laity, and we start off with the laity, the common lay people, at the time of revelation, at the time of infallibility, and we see what the ruling there is. And then if there's no ruling, then we go to other devices, such as the definition of the word according to the lexicographers of that time, i.e. those lexicons, the books on the meanings of the words, which give the definition of the words of that time. And if that doesn't help either, then we go to the common layperson of today. It's a long process, and with different rulings, it applies differently. But it has a lot of important connotations. But anyway, here we go to, and there are differences of opinion amongst the jurists. This is just one hierarchy of procedure that is undergone by the jurists. But anyway, this is an Orfi matter, and it's traced back to how the common layperson, how would they calculate their ma'une? And here, if you go back to the time of formation, the time of infallibility, there we see that they would calculate things on a yearly basis, on an annual basis. They would calculate their ma'une. And even today, when you look at the tax forms, it's done on a yearly basis. It's an annual procedure that one undergoes. So it was the case, 1 year was the case, and it usually is even today. Now, this 1 year, does it apply to every ma'une, every item of ma'une? That's a different discussion. If you remember in the discussion on homes, there was a kind of extension of the ma'une according to some of the religious authorities. Now, one last point here is that, and this is very important to understand this next point, is that it's a difference of, not a difference, but I just want you to acknowledge the technical jargon used. Here, remember from day one in your khums year, the khums is levied on your annual gains. The leviability starts from day one of your annual gains. The payment, however, payment-wise, there's no duty to pay the khums until the khums year arrives. So you have this 1 year respite period, which has been granted, has been afforded out of divine grace. Although you can pay the khums of your annual gains on day two or day four, but you have also been granted this respite period payment-wise. So what I'm trying to say here is that this 1 year stipulation is not a prerequisite or an essential pillar. It's not a rukn in Arabic, or it's not a prerequisite of paying the khums. This is a very important sentence. And when we speak about altering the khums date, if you understand this point, you'll understand the next slide. So when it comes to, in relation to the domain of payment, this 1 year respite period isn't essential, isn't a prerequisite. It's been afforded out of divine grace. But leviability on annual gains is something which happens from day one. It's levied. But payment-wise, you have 1 year. You have a 1 year period. But this 1 year period doesn't mean you can't pay the khums on day two or day four. Why? Why is that the case? Because that khums is levied on day two and day four. So if you want, you can pay for it. But if you don't, it's not haram. And you have a 1 year respite period. Inshallah, I've managed to convey that point for you. Okay, so given that, let's go to the next slide. Can one change one's khums year? Slide 34. So here, if you look at the orange horizontal time scale indicator and March the 13th, the two stars, that's your khums date. The question now is, can one move one's khums year back or forward by, for example, 2 months, and thus change it to January or May, respectively? Your khums date is March the 13th. You want to now alter it to, and it was March the 13th because you started work then, for example, or you gained access to your salary on March the 13th. Whatever the reason, whatever your job, that is your khums date. It's assigned, and it wasn't in your hands. Now though, you want to go back. You want to make it January the 13th, or you want to make it May the 13th. Is this permissible or not? So, moving backwards is unproblematic, i.e., one can pay one's khums pertaining to annual gains left in January. So look at the second. Look at the second star of March the 13th, then it's April, May, June, July, August, September, and you keep on going. And then when you reach January, here you pay the khums, which of the annual gains that were left over until January. And then you start anew, and now January the 13th becomes your khums date. And you're allowed to do that because the khums was levied on your annual gains until January 2. Even on the first day of your annual gains, of acquiring annual gains, the khums is levied. So there is something which upon which the khums is levied. So on January 13th, whatever annual gains you have, the khums is levied, even though it's not wajib for you to pay it yet, but you want to change your khums date, you go back to on January 13th, 2 months before May the 13th, here you pay what you see, you calculate your annual gains, whatever's left of it, the khums is levied upon them, and therefore you pay it. And then that becomes your new khums date. But moving it forwards to May the 13th is problematic. Because if it happens in this fashion, that let's look at March the 2nd star again, March the 13th. Then you go April, May, June, July, August, September, October, November, December, January, February, March. And then April, May. And now you want to assign May the 13th as your khums date. That's problematic because in March, the 1 year respite period has ended and you had to execute your khums, but you didn't. And thus waiting until May, an extra 2 months, is tantamount to usurping the imam's belongings for 2 months. For 2 months here, because you're spending from the imam's money. A fifth of it was the imam's. You had to pay it on March the 13th. Now, for 2 months, what you're spending is you're usurping an amount of the imam's belongings, the 12th successor of the Holy Messenger's belongings. So here, what you would have to do, if you want to make your khums date March the 13th, you would have to pay off your khums, if you want to make it May the 13th rather, you have to pay off your khums on March the 13th, okay? And then, so you've carried out your duty there. Then 2 months passes, you pay your khums after those 2 months again on May the 13th, whatever's left from your annual gains in those 2 months. And then May the 13th becomes your khums date, May the 13th. And the reason I said the last point in the previous slide was important was this. Because that's why you're allowed to do these two procedures I've just explained. Because the khums is levied on your annual gains from day one, even though payment-wise you're granted and afforded a respite period. Now, can it be a date from the solar or Gregorian calendar? Yes, it can be. And all religious authorities allow either the solar, Gregorian or lunar calendars. They're all allowed. There may be one or two. That which comes to mind is Ayatollah Wahid Khorasani, who says that. And he doesn't give a fatwa. He says based on obligatory precaution, it has to be the lunar calendar. And finally, slide 35, can I have more than one khums date or year? Now, usually, especially in some countries, the norm is that everyone has one job and one means of earning or gaining, and that which they spend for their expenses is deducted from this income or gain. And so for such a majority, it's only natural that they have one khums year and they calculate it as that one khums year. There's no need for a second. For the majority, that is the norm. However, there are others who have two sources of income or one income, but they are now differentiating this one income. Here, with these two groups, let's see what's the ruling here. So, for those with more than one income, or it's one income but it's divided into different parts, here, there are those who have more than one income or gain, but the different incomes or gains are assimilated into one account, and one spends one's expenses from this one account, and any deduction of either income is automatically compensated by the profit of the other. So a conflation of incomes or gains arises, and for such people, one khums year is assigned. So they have two incomes, okay? One is, let's say, a taxi driver, and the other is a computer engineer. You have to forgive the examples. I could have given better examples, but This has just come to mind here. Because in some third world countries, being a taxi driver as a second job is quite popular. Although I don't do that, but it is quite a popular thing. So here, the expenses that you do for your taxi comes from the salary from your computer engineering, or the expenses that you go to work for your computer job is from the profit you get from your taxi driving. You see, that's what I mean. It's conflated into one account. So they have one khumsiyah. But no, there's a second group of people where they have two incomes, but they're mutually exclusive. What I mean by mutually exclusive is this, going back to the same example. The costs of traveling for your computer job or buying materials from for your computer job, you never use the money from your taxi job, or vice versa. Expenses for your taxi, if it needs repairing, you never use your profits of your computer job for that. They are mutually exclusive. Yes, for your ma'une, you know, eating, and you can use from either. But mutually exclusive means when you want to do expenses specific to one of them, you can't spend it from the other, gains from the other job. If you do that, that goes to type one. Conflation, you have one khumsiyah. But if you keep them mutually exclusive, you can have two khums dates. So look, type two, those who have different incomes or gains and opens a different account for each, i.e. the spending and gaining of each account is mutually exclusive. I explained what that meant. Sometimes, though, the different incomes or gains are from different jobs, but sometimes it may be the same job, but one has mutually exclusive accounts pertaining to that one income. So that one income may have, you separated it into two different parts, two different domains, and the profits of each are mutually exclusive. You don't spend from the domain of one for the purposes of the other. If that is kept and you are strictly abide by that, then that would be okay to have two home states. And one can give many examples here, and it may come up with the questions and answers, and where, for example, one receives a certain amount of money and then in the next month is one's home state. Can one, theoretically, then one has to pay. It's an annual gain. It's a large amount of money. One would have to do it and do it wholeheartedly. It's the imam's money. But theoretically, can you then delay it and make a new khum state? These are matters which arise. It's possible. It's not encouraged, but it's possible. But there are certain things which have to be met. Certain criteria have to be met. And then imagine, if you keep on doing this with many things, how are you going to keep record of all this? So for simplicity's sake, the best route is just to have one khums date. But you are allowed to have more than one if the correct criteria are met. Okay, now the next slide, 36, is when X item has the khums levied upon it, the manner of this leviability is conceived in different ways. This slide now wants to say what is exactly happening when the khums is levied on something. What happens exactly? And we'll explain this, inshallah, and the connotations that it has at the start of the next session, inshallah. Okay, now I want to go through a number of questions, because there were quite a few of them that were sent. I'll try to cover as much as I can. The first one, if you are dependent on someone and receiving pocket money, how is it dealt with within the khums laws? Well, usually it's seen as a gift, and if any of that gift remains, if it's a television, for example, or a toy, and it's used, there's no khums. But if it's cash, because you say it's pocket money and all that, and it's usually seen as a gift, that will whatever remains of it will have the khums applied and levied upon it. Well, you'd have to pay for it at one's khums date if you follow Ayatollah Sistani. With Ayatollah Khamenei, gifts don't apply. Although here, I'm assuming the question is the questioner is following Ayatollah Sistani. So I'll be giving his ruling, and that is that whatever remains of the gift at the end of the year, at your khums date, here, that would have the khums to be paid upon it. The khums has to be paid. Then the questioner continues, if you find out you have outstanding khums still pending to pay off from your past years, does khums of current year become incumbent to pay when the time comes? Well, yes, this year's is this year's, and considering this year, you have to pay it off. But in relation to the past years that you have not paid the khums, you're indebted. You have to calculate it. That's a duty upon you. It was haram that you didn't do it. Let's assume you were ignorant in relation to it. That has to be calculated. But in relation to this year's has to be calculated separately. Then the question says, a follow-up to that, what if you spend on some extravagant expenses also in the current year? For example, giving gifts or dinner party beyond your average financial capacity, does khums on those become liable in the current year? And also in the perspective of the case mentioned above. Well, yes, those, if it qualifies as extravagance, yes, and it seems that it does, the khums will be levied on the surplus, that which qualifies as extravagant, whatever surplus that was, a fifth of it would have to be paid as khums. Now here, when you say, if the and also in the perspective of the case mentioned above, here, if, because you were speaking about pocket money, so if the extravagance was carried out with your pocket money, yes, that extravagant surplus, that part, is liable to khums. Although, according to Ayatollah Sistani, when you reach your khums date, whatever remains of it will have the khums, but the extravagant part too. When you reach the khums date, that surplus in extravagance, in israf, you would have to calculate the khums of that too. With Ayatollah Khamenei, in this particular example, since the pocket money was a gift and there's no khums levied on it, buying something or spending extravagantly with that will not have the khums levied on it, because the nature of pocket money, the gift, the nature of a gift or present, it has no khums on it. So there will be no calculation of khums on that extravagant surplus, albeit a sin to spend extravagantly. However, with Ayatollah Khamenei, if you do, although this is just for completion's sake, if you do buy a gift extravagantly or spend extravagantly with your annual gains, that's a different story. The khums will be levied there on the surplus. So in this case, though, you receive the pocket money, you spent extravagantly, and therefore it has to be compensated by giving its khums, that surplus, on it at the end of the year. The same question says, if my bank account has money from myself and another person, both mixed, and if I loaned some khums done money, khumsated money, money which has its khums has already been given, so it's pure money now, and I loaned some khumsated money from it to someone and got it back, let's say after a moment of time, period of time, he doesn't specify when, but before putting it back into the bank account, I had to also use that money of this other person. I had to also use the money of this other person to carry out some of his work. That other person in which their bank, their money is mixed in one bank account. In this case, do I need to go to the hassle to deposit back my khums paid money into the bank account and then proceed to remove his partner's money, to do his work? Or can I just use the money in my hand by changing the intention that now this money is his And once done, then put the balance back into the bank account, which originally consists of money from both sides. Well, here, yes, you can change the intention here. It would be okay. I'm not sure exactly which aspect you want me to focus on here. For example, if you want to do something on his behalf, that person needs to know that you're doing it. Otherwise, it will qualify as an uncommissioned transaction. And even if he gives consent afterward, that would be okay. There's no problem there. It's a sound transaction. But what I'm guessing is that you're fearing that when you change the intention with the money, that now the money which remains for you in the bank account is not khumsated, maybe. And that's where your worry is. And that, so when you do your work, you do his work for him with money which is khumsated, which was yours and khumsated, but you didn't put it and you used it as his, you changed your intention and used it now to do his work, your fear is that the money which now remains in the bank account, which is not khumsated, will that cause a problem? No, it won't. So there's no fear that, you know, don't fear that it's not khumsated. You can change your intention and do everything as you have done in this question, and it won't cause any problems. Okay, so that was one question. Another question says, can I, salamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, can I pay khums from my pocket on behalf of a living person? Or do I have to wait for that person to die? Okay. Now, to put it bluntly, yes, you have to wait for that person to die. And then you pay their khums. Now, I'm assuming that person isn't a khums giver. So according to Ayatollah Sistani, those who don't give khums or have a lot of shortcomings in relation to their khums, here the inheritors, for example, don't have to pay their khums for them. It's not necessary. It's not a duty. It's not wajib. This is one of Ayatollah Sistani's unique fatwas compared to others. So first of all, you don't, but it's very noble that you want to do it. Now here, I'm not sure if you're an inheritor or you're not an inheritor of this person. But anyway, if you want to give every person's khums is their own duty. So they have to give it. If you want to give it, you have to wait for them to die. But there are ways to do it when they are alive. For example, you can give them a present and then they give you the present back and say, pay my khums with this present. Or they can assign you as their power of attorney in paying their khums. And once you are now their wakil, their power of attorney, you can go and give it for them. So there are ways to do it. Okay, a follow-up for the dying situation. The questioner continues. If I have made the intention to pay for that person who has not paid khums, and I cannot pay the whole amount at one go when he dies, does this punishment get halted? Does his punishment in the hereafter get halted because of my sincere intention to pay? Does this punishment get halted? Or does this punishment reduce in installments in the grave until I pay his debt all off in similar installments? Well, this is a question of qiyamah, the day of resurrection. No one knows. But let's say all other things are standard and constant and everything is pending on this one issue. Because in qiyamah, God knows, only Allah knows how we're going to be judged. There are so many things we've done which may come to our aid, which may not come to our aid, and so on and so forth. So I don't want to categorically say this person will go to heaven or hell, but very theoretically, I'm just answering, given everything else was perfect and the only problem was this one issue, here, all the installments must be paid until their fiqhi punishment ends. But you shouldn't be short-sighted in relation to the tariqah. That continues, and the ethical hell may still continue and may even be worse and more burning than the fiqhi punishment, which ends when all your installments are given. One can speak a lot here, one can give a lecture here if one wanted to, yes. And then the question says, what if I don't know the exact amount that person owes and I make a rough estimate towards the Sharia's favor, i.e. I choose a higher amount? So they say, it may be X amount, it may be Y, Y is more, but I will calculate Y. And this amount, even then in reality, ends up as being less than actually owned in front of Allah. They calculated Y, the higher estimate, but in reality, it was even more than Y. Y was a lesser estimate than what was reality. But what happened was that became evident later. What happened was they paid Y, having paid this amount, does the person still suffer? Even if in reality the amount concluded is reached, in agreement after consultation with the mujtahid or his representative of whom I do taqleed. Well, yes, the punishment will still continue. Given everything else is a constant, that punishment will still suffer, because that the marija, the religious authority's conclusion, was when there was doubt. Okay, and you very nobly chose Y, the higher amount, and the marija concluded Y as the amount, but that was when there was doubt. But now you're saying, in reality, it became evident later that it was even more than Y. Well, if it's more than Y, now it's a different subject matter. More than Y would have to be paid. Now, the marija may forgive you. That's nothing to do with me. I'm giving you the theory here. In theory, once it becomes known that actually the amount was Y plus 5 units, then that is the khums which has to be paid. Because you're still indebted, and that debt upon you needs liberating. From the same questioner, when a person dies, what should be taken care of first by the living for the deceased? Is it namaz, salat, sawm, fasting, hajj, which hasn't been performed intentionally? Because if it wasn't done unintentionally, they never had the opportunity, that wouldn't be a debt. Zakat, khums, debts to people, and many others I may not know. Could you list according to priority the top 3 or 5 and why? Does khums reach this 3 to 5 list? Now, this is a very lengthy question. It requires one whole lecture. I couldn't find the answer to this in Ayatollah Sistani's treatises, which are at hand. Maybe I didn't have enough time, but I did find it in the marginal notes of Ayatollah Khoi, rahmatullah alayh, in his marginal annotations of the book, the fiqhi book called Urwatul Wuthqa. Now, an Ayatollah Sistani may have the same ruling, but that I would have to confirm. But if it's a similar ruling to Ayatollah Khoi, here, if the property, the wealth of the deceased is sufficient, it may be sufficient, it may not be sufficient. If it's sufficient, then all these things that you've mentioned, they have to be done. They have to be done. It's wajib. And the order does not matter. It doesn't matter. Just do them one by one. But let's say, although note that with Salat and with Sawm, here too, with Ayatollah Sistani, there's no duty for the person to, the elder son, for example, or the inheritors, to perform the Salat or the fasting if the deceased was someone who didn't pay importance to them and never performed them, or performed them, you know, not in an abiding manner. But if you don't have, if the wealth left by the deceased is not sufficient, here, Ayatollah Khoi, rahmatullah alayhi, said, you first have to go do the Hajj. In relation to the rest, pay them off by ratios. This is when you don't have enough wealth. So let's say after you go to Hajj, what remains is 140 units of money. 140 units. I chose this as an example to make the mathematics a bit easier. Now, you're in debt 400 units, you're in debt with khums, 200 units with zakat, 100 units to people. You're in debt. But you only have 140 units left. Here, 400, 200 and 100 is 700. So 4/7 goes to khums, 2/7 goes to zakat, 1/7 goes to people. So here, 140 is left. You calculate the ratio. 4/7 of the 140 goes for your debt in Homs. 2/7 goes to your debt pertaining to Zakat, and 1/7 to people. And the rest is unpaid for, and that may be problematic for you when you look at it on an akhirah, hereafter basis. So that's what is meant by paying in ratios. But as I say, what Ayatollah Sistani is ruling on that, I'm not sure. I would have to check that further. Okay, there are many other questions, inshallah, we'll cover them in the next session. وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين.